Hello and welcome to the 7th episode of the Right Minds podcast. It is Tuesday, 4th of May at the time of recording, and likely Friday the 7th at the time of release. It has been 2 years to the month since the last episode, which was the 6th episode of this podcast. And the podcast was the idea of my friend Jesse Anderson, who co-hosted 5 of the 6 previous episodes with me. He sadly took his own life nearly 2 years ago, and I struggled to pick up the microphone to continue this podcast. A short obituary that I wrote will be linked in the description accompanying this recording. As the months went on and other events got in the way, I ended up starting a weekly live stream with another friend, Tim Wilms from Australia. But Origin, who guest hosted the 4th episode of the podcast with me, kept open his offer to return and to make the continuation of this podcast a reality. This year, I have finally taken him up on that offer with Trad-Tasman Talk, which is the live stream with Tim Wilms, now happening every fortnight. And the Right Minds podcast will also happen every fortnight, meaning that there will be some form of weekly audio-visual content coming from Right Minds, which I'm quite excited about again. So welcome to the show, Origin.
Good evening, Dewar, and hello to everyone out in podcast land, internet land. It's good to be here.
I appreciate you coming back. What sparked this particular podcast is not a current event from this week, as previous podcasts have been about, but this was something that happened several months ago. It was the release of the Royal Commission report on the Christchurch attack. There were some interesting things in the report that you wanted to discuss, and I believe the first one was around the subject of what is called, what is referred to in the report as replacement theory.
If I could just stop you there, Dewar, it's actually not even referred to as a theory at all. In fact, nowhere in the Royal Commission report is Great Replacement associated with the word theory. So they just refer to it as the Great Replacement.
That's right, and I was just about to continue there by saying that was as separate from the Great Replacement conspiracy or any form of conspiracy. They talk a little bit about replacement migration, incredibly briefly, not in any detail, but as a real thing. And this was something that stuck out to you and to me as well as very different from what would be the media narrative, which was to say that there is no such thing as replacement or population replacement in general. At least they would criticize the entire idea or anybody who would discuss it as a vast conspiracy. And so I think this is at least an opportunity for us to talk about what is the difference between replacement migration and the Great Replacement conspiracy.
Yeah, and I think an important point to make is that we can take a totally objective standpoint on this, and we can say, because we don't know what the effects are going to be of a replacement migration. We don't know what the effects will be in 20 or 30 years' time. So we can't say if it is a good or a bad thing. But I think what bugs me the most is that people who are in the media establishment, in academia, people who should know better, and people on the left wing in the public discourse, they don't want to acknowledge it as a even as a possibility.
Yeah,
and I find it troubling because there's statistical evidence to say that whether it be good or whether it be bad, that the demographics are changing.
Obviously is the alternative. Then is there's no discussion that takes place. What happens is that people are driven to a particular ideology. Right, this is what happens. People discover some facts. They don't know how to talk about those facts, and so they end up in a dark place. And I think that's really where the initial focus of this discussion will be, separating out the insane, separating out what in internet speak would be the LARPers or the Fed posters or those who posting on the darker parts of the internet and believe there's some form of racial struggle going on, which has led to the idea of the Great Replacement.
Yeah, I mean, and for example, you'll still have some people who may have the subjective perception that they are being replaced, and that may be their subjective reality. So their phenomenological experience is one where they constantly encountering the unfamiliar. And maybe that of, and this could be for Māori too, there, you know, Māori spaces are definitely changing.
They were colonized, they were replaced in many respects in New Zealand. That was something they experienced since the sort of early to late 1800s.
Yeah, and I mean, I've got my own theories on this, that they developed a Christian culture that was nestled in the as part of the British colonial expansion. And I don't think that was necessarily wholly a bad thing. But what has happened is that postmodern radicals have ripped the rug from underneath them, and they have once again have tried to find themselves, and they've unwittingly been provided an outlet for that, which is identity politics. And we can see it in the mainstream media now. This push to identify by group alone is being pushed very, very hard now. It doesn't matter what the last 150 years, you know, contained in terms of the experience of, you know, Māori and European culture together as a bicultural society. That's all out the window now. There are
And this is going to be an entirely different lengthy subject that I'm sure that we'll cover in a future podcast. But one of the things I was just thinking, one of the things the Royal Commission report actually mentions a lot is Māori and the bicultural realities of New Zealand, which I thought was an interesting tangential focus of the report while I was reading through it, that didn't seem to directly have anything to do with the terrorist attack, because it was actually driven obviously by an outsider. Brenton Tarrant was an Australian. He was driven by these internet, or at least largely European and American white identity ideologies. And the report tried to tie that back in. And I guess we could say that they were trying to fulfill their own agendas there. But that's not something that really came out of the report, at least said drove the terrorist attack, which was largely around the subject of the culture clash between Christianity and Islam, I believe, was something that they nailed down as something they put down as a primary focus, as their claims. Yeah. So I think first up, we'll backtrack right to the resolution, I guess, of the court case and the sentencing of Brenton Tarrant. And I think that you've got some thoughts.
Yeah, so the sentencing notes for the Queen and Brenton Tarrant are available online to anyone if they wish to read them. What I would want to dispel here, and it's for any of the LARPers and the Fed posters who are in any way thinking that this act was justified, there are two things that really stood out for me. There was the people that the worshippers that stood outside the mosque, and they were welcoming people into the mosque. And then there's the child that was gunned down. And I'll just read these excerpts from the sentencing decision of Justice Manda. So at paragraph 7, he says, "You took with you two semi-automatic firearms and multiple magazines and made your way along the footpath to the mosque. At that time, four worshippers, Monir Suleiman, Sayed Ali, Amjad Hamid, and Hussein Mustafa, were at the mosque's front entrance. Without warning, you discharged a shotgun multiple times in quick succession, killing each of them. A wounded Mr. Mustafa was dispatched by you at point-blank range with the shots to the back and head." I mean, that is just chilling. And someone, regardless of theological differences, someone who is welcoming someone armed, unfortunately, unbeknownst to him, into the mosque only to be gunned down is actually really horrific and tragic, and that needs to be acknowledged. And the second part that I wish to read out is that paragraph 12, and for me it's the murder of the truly innocent, which is a heinous sin. And I would just read out the following. "You moved closer to each piled group of people lying deceased, wounded or feigning death on each side of the main prayer room. Worshippers who are either crying out for help or who appeared to be alive were systematically shot in the head. One of those was a 3-year-old child, Mukad Ibrahim. He was clinging to his father's leg, and you murdered him with two aimed shots." that to me is just completely insane and sociopathic and deranged. Yeah. Totally diabolical and satanic.
Yeah, well, certainly the case.
And you know, right at the end of the decision, and I do recommend people read this, and I think it's something that both you and I agree on, is that the Justice Mander's comments here, and I'll just read a quick selection of them at paragraphs 184 and 185. Justice Mander goes on to state, "Your crimes, however, are so wicked that even if you are detained until you die, it will not exhaust the requirements of punishment and denunciation." And then he goes on to say, "But I do not consider, however long the length of your incarceration during your lifetime, that it could, even in a modest way, atone for what you have done." And in paragraph 185, "For completeness, I record that if I am wrong to sentence you on this basis, that the court retains a residual discretion to decide whether to impose a life sentence without parole." And this is my emphasis here, "despite having concluded that no minimum term of imprisonment would be sufficient to hold you to account for the harm you have done or to denounce your conduct, a whole life sentence would have to follow in any event." So reading between the lines there, it's quite fair to say, well, if life parole with no hope of release is not enough to atone for the damage that Tarrant has done, then the only available option would have been execution.
He's acknowledging that our justice system does not have a sentence, does not allow a sentence. It does not allow justice that would be appropriate for a crime like this. And this is what the death penalty was for. We don't have it anymore. And that, I think, is another disgrace, a shame to New Zealand, actually, to not be able to dispense justice, to not legally be able to dispense justice.
You get to murder 51 people and still get to live. So there's no justice for the families and the friends of people of the worshippers who are murdered in those mosques. There's none. Right. Not even if he dies of a natural death. There is no justice that's been meted out.
No, not in this world anyway, but that is, that is the duty of the government. That should be the number one responsibility of government, should be to ensure that justice is done and that it is seen to be done. And what a shame that cannot be the case in New Zealand.
Yeah. So, I mean, moving forward after that, and it's something that's so harrowing and so disgraceful,
I appreciate that you've pointed out that this is, you know, to go through these distressing details, because people don't take this as seriously as they should have. I think in many cases that people sort of brush past this and don't realize there were 51 people murdered in cold blood. There were, you know, women, there were children, and whatever your politics, this is an absolutely heinous event. It is a shame to see people, to see people conflate reasonable political opinions with this, right? That's what happens out there on the internet.
It's on the left and the right. So we've got conservative boomers or conservative boomers, you know, making like just unbelievably stupid and retarded point of view monologues on YouTube, and they aren't particularly sensitive. And then we've got the left wing, the extreme left, basically using this as a bludgeon to crack down on any opposing view of progressive politics. Anything that's opposed to progressive politics, they'll somehow incorporate this.
Well, they use this to further their own political agenda. And then the victims become tokens that are waved around in order to support particular political ends of these people. What came out of this was the Royal Commission. A Royal Commission of Inquiry was set up to investigate this. And this report was released a few months ago at a time where I don't remember seeing much on this report. I don't remember much commentary being on it. I haven't seen much analysis of it. And that's one of the things that prompted us to have a sit down here and to look into some of the details, perhaps over a few episodes.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the points, are we going to go into the the actual details of the report now? Are we going to tackle replacement migration?
Well, that is one of the things in the report. I think before we really get into how they talk about the different bits of analysis that they've done, especially their political analysis, some of which I find quite flippant, perhaps. I mean, it doesn't seem particularly robust, some of their political analysis, but it all starts off with replacement migration, Islamic migration, and the entire issues of ethnic identity are in this report. So I think it's good to tackle the specific subject of immigration and replacement migration before we go into everything else. And I think it's a good idea to disentangle these ideas from the actions of the extreme sociopathic murderer, Brenton Tarrant, which you've just gone through and read out the sentencing notes, which show how absolutely obscene his behavior was. And now we can talk about where did this idea come from?
Yeah, so we need to tackle the replacement migration issue factually. And I would start with the UN report, which was authored in the year 2000, and it was called, funnily enough, Replacement Migration. Is it a solution to declining and aging populations? The report itself discusses declining fertility rates, or aka birth rates, in the West and also Japan and Korea. And it proposed, I think, about six different scenarios of how they would tackle this issue. And one with, you know, like opening the borders as much as possible to allow working age populations to come into the country. And the they did a number of projections. They saw that the Western populations are aging. There's a specific number of people they need in the working age population to sustain the economy. So it's driven by economics.
So you need to maintain economic growth. You need to have at least 2 or 3 percentage points of GDP growth every single year. You need to maintain generous welfare benefits. You need to obviously pay for the entire bureaucratic state. So that requires economic growth, and that has to be met with more people.
They acknowledge this as part of the process of globalization taking place throughout the world, and that it's influencing the economic, political, and cultural character of both sending and receiving countries. So I think that's part of a quote in chapter 5, but by saying sending and receiving countries, so the sending countries are actually losing their best and brightest that would otherwise be staying in their countries and providing the innovation to grow and better their economies and improve the living standards and in their countries of origin. Mm-hmm. And the receiving countries are obviously receiving the best and brightest, and it's changing the youth, I suppose, of the country.
And this is something I've mentioned on my shows before, and something that I've heard from conservatives, particularly in Canada and the United States, referred to as plunder and exploitation, but of human capital rather than resources.
But instead of sending sugarcane back from the Caribbean, they're sending the IT programmers from Calcutta.
Yes, exactly. And so instead of sending in, or at least going into Somalia and digging up their gold and their diamonds and shipping them back to Europe and America, instead it's their doctors and their teachers and all of those who have the resources, intelligence, and the means to get out and to live a better life in the West. And not to blame those people who want to get out and get to a better better place. Yeah. Definitely wouldn't blame them. But the end result is, of course, that Europe, America, New Zealand, Australia are enriched by these people, and that the countries themselves are impoverished by that. The only thing that can change the composition of people moving is basically like war or famine or massive upheaval, mm-hmm. where you have large amounts of refugees. And that's what we've seen in more recent times. That's obviously not what this report is referring to. And that's not what the bulk of movement of people, the bulk of replacement migration targets people who can provide a lot of economic benefit right off the bat.
Yeah, exactly. And because there's a graph.
Refugees aren't going to grow your GDP that quickly, but somebody who's got a, you know, somebody who's got some formal education, well, yeah, they're going to be incredibly useful to growing your GDP.
And I suppose, I mean, it's probably a topic for another podcast, but tying it into the migration compact, the UN migration compact. But
that's more targeted towards relocating people.
Yeah, who are just straight refugees.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I mean, I'd like to talk about there's Table 5 in the UN report, which talks about like the total fertility rates, and I'm sort of making this point to dispel the left-wing myth that fertility rates and the population demographics, the percentages, dispel the myth that they're not changing. So in Table 5, I've just used the United Kingdom, the United States as the example. The UN report stated that in 2020 to 2025, that the fertility rate was going to be about 1.90 births for the population as a whole, and that's for both the UK and the United States.
Yeah. Number of children per woman. I believe those numbers now are much lower than 1.9.
Yeah, so the graph that I've got below is, obviously our viewers can't hear this, but we've got some data up.
I will link some of this. I'll link this report in the description if you're listening to the podcast. If you're watching a visual version of it, I will try and put this up on the screen, but no promises on that. But it will definitely be linked below.
Yeah, so the current rates for the United States are 1.73 births per woman, and United Kingdom is 1.68. So it's far lower than what was projected. Actually projected. So fertility rates are, I mean that is birth control, that is abortion, that is people
declining family formation.
Declining family formation is huge. The emphasis on the individual above at least the family collective. Just turning our attentions to the rates in New Zealand, and just I suppose in a way to make this New Zealand specific, because we could talk about other countries, but this is essentially mirrored in other countries in the West, but not, however, in Japan and Korea, which were also mentioned in the UN report. If the data from New Zealand, when we look at the 1961 New Zealand census, is that, now, I'm going to say this rightly or wrongly, whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, it's unknown. We don't know what the outcomes will be of the changing demographics. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some people believe it's a good thing. Some people believe it's a bad thing.
You know, the fact that it is changing is not a myth. So if we look at the 1961 census, the percentage of people who were of European extraction was 91.8%. Then we fast forward to 50 years later to the 2013 New Zealand census. That number is now 74%. And then we fast forward again to the 2018 census. The number has now dropped to 71.76. And I don't have the exact number for the 2020 census, but I think it was around like a flat 70%, like just above 70%.
And I had a quick look here at the population projections from Statistics New Zealand through to 2038. And they project that will decline further to 66%, which I guess would match up about a 2 percentage points per census.
Yeah, roughly. Well, about a 3% drop, or 2.5% drop. So it's really not a myth that the demographic rates are changing. The European birth rate is really, really low. But interestingly, the Māori birth rate is actually also quite low. Do you want to speak to that?
Dropping. So the average number of children born, broken down by ethnic groups, so specifically looking, the average is about 1.7, slightly lower for Asians, but the birth rate that was much higher was for Māori and Pacific women, who in the 1980s, the average was about 5 for each. And as the data we have for 2013 shows, that has fallen to just below 3 for both. So we're on track, I guess if that trend had continued by the current year, we're looking at probably half the birth rate of what they had in the 80s. So two and a half, which is much higher than the average. It's much higher. It's still above replacement levels, but it goes to show in the overall statistics, the overall population statistics that we were referring to before. One of the things that the Statistics New Zealand projects for 2038 is that at some point the Asian, the percentage of, or at least the share of New Zealand's population that is of Asian origin is going to surpass that of Maori ancestry. So within the next, and they projected this to happen sometime in the next few years. We don't know what's happened with the current travel situation, but as I've said from these birth rates, Asian women on average have less, far fewer children than Maori or Pacific women, but it's the immigration, it's the replacement migration, essentially an economic policy of both Labor and national governments has actually at this point or within the next few years displaced Maori as the largest minority ethnic group in New Zealand to the second largest, and that's purely through replacement migration happening in New Zealand at the moment. You can see that with these birth rates, even with higher birth rates, the growing New Zealand's population through immigration is actually causing demographic change rapidly in New Zealand's ethnic minorities in terms of the percentage of the population they have.
And I think it would be quite worrying for Māori, just because Māori do make up a larger proportion of those who are in the low socioeconomic status, whereas Asian immigrants tend to be typically wealthier. So in terms of housing, there is greater buying power with Asian families. Obviously, the Asian families tend to have both a husband and wife in the family unit. So that obviously increases their buying power and their ability to purchase houses.
We're trying to avoid making judgments on whether this is good or bad, but yeah, you're highlighting some cases where people might be worried.
If I was a poor Māori, yeah. I've seen it online. It's not something that is going to go away. That Māori are feeling especially aggrieved by increased rates of immigration. In terms of their inability to purchase a house of their choosing in a suburb that they would like, that may actually be they may have some affinity with, in terms of being tangata whenua of that particular area, of that particular iwi. Right. They may have to look and moving outside if they're from Tamaki Makaurau, or they might have to go down the line to Waikato. So there are all those cultural things that need to be
absolutely considered. And I wonder if, again, we will touch on this in a later episode when we're dealing with the political issues now that are highlighted between decisions that the government is making to sort of compensate for this, I wonder, to some degree, because the electoral power of Maori in that case is decreasing if they're if they're no longer the largest minority ethnic group, and potentially whether or not the government is kind of trying to compensate replacement migration with sort of rights, the indigenous rights policies. I think that's speculation for another time. For some reason, these are both happening at the same time, and I suspect they're not entirely unrelated, both caused by government policy.
Yeah, exactly. And they know about it. So, I mean, just to recap here, the birth rates are declining in both European and Māori populations in New Zealand. The overall percentage proportion has declined, whilst others have increased. Replacement migration is definitely a fact. So we can dispel the myth that this is not happening. It is happening, and we need to have a conversation about it.
If it's not something that is allowed to be discussed, if there's no discussion on it at all, there is an increased risk that people who are not allowed to bring their grievances into the public sphere will undergo some form of radicalization. And that's what the Royal Commission report says that it's trying to reduce, is trying to identify how are people radicalized? How do we stop people from radicalized? How do we increase social cohesion? One of the interesting things that the report puts a lot of effort on is not just increasing, So it's not just looking at what caused the Christchurch attack, but they go into they devote an entire part on social cohesion and embracing diversity. They see these concerns as wider than just a foreign terrorist attack targeting New Zealand because he thought it was a good place to target, but seeing that, hey, perhaps that there is the future risk of terrorist attacks that are not directly related to this issue, but that are caused by a lack of social cohesion. But they don't really identify that, like, hey, maybe there's government policy that's decreasing social cohesion. At least having gone through the report there, I have not found any, recommendations where they said, hey, here's some government policy that's might be reducing social cohesion, other than just the usual of, okay, well, we need to make it harder. We need to make it harder for people to find weapons to carry out these attacks. We need to make it harder for people to spread views that we see as being extremist. Essentially, repression is what they identify as the problem areas, without actually delving into any of the real issues. It's just clearly of, okay, how can we paper this over without looking at the issues that our policies are causing?
Yeah, and not only that, is that the policies themselves are a disservice to 150 years of shared history between the British Empire and Māori, and that they are the bicultural fabric of Aotearoa New Zealand. And a lot of people have problems with me saying that, but on both the left and the right.
Yeah, I'm expecting the angry comments already. I'm the one that has to respond to the angry comments, not you. So thank you.
Yeah, I mean, but there was a treaty, and it was signed between two groups of people, and it wasn't signed with Germans. It wasn't signed with Chinese. Mm-hmm. It wasn't signed with Africans. It wasn't signed with the Finnish or the Spanish. It was signed with people Dutch. Of the Brit or the Dutch. It was signed by with people of the British Isles and Māori. The collective known as Māori. And I mean, it's almost like it's just being frittered away, and it sort of counts for nothing. And I think that's extremely sad, because that is its own diverse and unique bicultural flourishing that was, you know, found in its own geographical space in this part of the world, and that has been changing. And we don't know what the outcomes of these changes will be, but potentially.
And they may be good, but... Yep. Obviously, as you're probably going to say, potentially they can be quite harmful.
Yeah, they potentially can be quite harmful, and especially for those who make up the lower socioeconomic rungs of society. Unfortunately, that's just the way. But basically, these policies, all they do is increase the wealth of the plutocrats, the movers and shakers of each particular company, country, company. I mean, company is the is appropriate. Yeah,
these UN reports. As the one that we've discussed from 21 years ago now, they are all there to further the interests of global capital. And yet we live in a weird universe where supposedly the left, which is supposed to be opposed to the interests of global capital, seems to be entirely okay with it. Right, they're more than happy to further the aims of global capital, and it's strange.
It's a revenue stream for them, not all of them, but for a vast majority of them, especially in BreedTube, it's a revenue stream. So it suits them fine.
Perhaps another topic there. I've got a lot more questions and comments here to go into some of the nitty gritty of the Royal Commission report into the Christchurch attack. But I'm going to save these for another time, since I think we've spent more than enough time on this part one, and this is probably best to save a part two for looking specifically at how the report itself handles what they consider right wing. So they devote quite a bit of space into finding academics who can help them break the right wing into forms of radical right and extreme right, and to identify three different versions of nationalism, and then to identify various different types of microaggressions and extremism that could be spread by these categories that they've identified. And I think we can look specifically at what sort of how the government pats itself on the back, something I've referred to earlier already, is that they don't really identify anything that the government has done wrong. But I believe that the nitty-gritty is perfect to say for another time, since we've delved very much into the details of
and just one final word. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just one final word, you were touching on nationalism, and the Royal Commission report touches on nationalism. Well, this affects all forms of nationalism, and there is a Maori nationalist movement as well. So, I mean, it has been suggested to a close friend of both of ours, Dewa, that perhaps many of these policies and these changes are actually to disempower further forms of Maori nationalism moving forward. So, I mean, that's also another topic for another time. It's all about a number of families and political organizations that are just striving for power, and and that corrupts, furthers their own agenda. And don't have much else to say.
Thank you very much for joining me on the show tonight. We will return in 2 weeks with another episode, and we're going to continue on a similar topic. We're going to continue looking into
the report itself,
of the report itself, and perhaps we'll deal with some questions or comments that we may get from this episode. I don't know. We obviously will record them fresh every fortnight, so there's a chance for people listening to put some questions in that we could answer during these podcasts. Rather than going into weekly events on these podcasts, we want to go into some of these deeper topics that usually will stretch out over a long period of time, especially obviously the work involved in the Royal Commission report. It took them nearly 2 years to generate the report, so that's not something that's a week, that's not part of the week's news, so to speak.
No, not at all.
All right. It is tradition to conclude the podcast with a suitable piece of classical music, and I've asked you for a suggestion, and I believe you've actually come up with something quite appropriate for everything from my opening remarks, from the origins of this podcast, and also the specific events that we've discussed in the podcast.
Yeah, so the piece tonight is a group organized by Jordi Savall, a Basque instrumentalist, his group Hesperian 21. This particular track is taken from the album Lacrime Caravaggio, and the track is titled In Memoriam. Enjoy. And
thank you. I will play just 30 seconds or so at the end of this episode, after the closing remarks, and I would strongly encourage you to go and listen to the entire piece, and I will link it in the description below. Origin says that it's an amazing piece. I haven't listened to all of it myself yet, but I certainly will after I finish preparing this podcast. And this podcast is available to listen to on the Right Minds website, rightminds.nz. It's available via your RSS reader as well. There's a link to the feed in the description. I also upload a video version to YouTube and Odyssey, and I would encourage you to follow along to the Telegram channel at Dewa De Boer on Telegram. Again, this will be linked in
Telegram. The
description. And it's lots of interesting stuff in the chat there. There's also a monthly newsletter on the website. And again, subscribe to whichever method you're using to listen to this version of the podcast, and you will know to tune back every fortnight. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much for joining me, and good night.
Good night.